Welcome, listeners, to the next edition of The Editor's Desk. I'm Rusty Reno, editor of First Things, and today I'm with Gladden Pappin, a First Things author and now an international diplomat and man of mystery. And you're here in New York, and I thought it'd be great for us to just sit down and talk about things in general. So welcome to the podcast, Gladden.
Great to be here, Rusty. Great to see you, and thanks so much.
So tell listeners, you were a professor of political science or political philosophy at University of Dallas.
That's right.
And you took a position in Budapest. So tell us what you're doing these days.
So that's right. I was at the University of Dallas until about this time last year. And since then, I've become president of the Hungarian Institute of International Affairs, which is a think tank that's attached to the Prime Minister's Office of Hungary. So we are the foreign policy think tank working directly for Prime Minister Orban. We have about 50 staff, and we try to study everything that's going on in the world and figure out why it matters to Hungary and try to explain also why the viewpoint of this country in Central Europe that has maybe implausibly gotten a lot of attention is also important for the world as well.
8 million people live in Hungary?
Close to 10.
For 10 million people, I gotta say, the Western press is fixated on Hungary.
They really are, and I've thought about this, and I think that it's because Hungary is a kind of counterexample within the West. They created a kind of you could say iron curtain of disinformation around the country. They made everyone think that it's a very, very scary place where there's no freedom whatsoever and there are terrible anti-LGBT laws, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality is that Hungary basically preserved the status quo ante of Western norms that pretty much everyone accepted until 20 years ago.
So,
and because it's doing that successfully, now, they don't want you to see what's going on there.
It seems a lot of it just revolves around the rainbow flag issues.
Well, that's true. And I think that unfortunately what we've seen is that American foreign policy itself, America's attitude toward other countries has been inflected by these cultural, ideological issues as well. You know, there was a conservative government in Poland until last year as well. And while a conservative government was in Poland, Poland was very bad, according to the U.S. and the Western elites. There was no rule of law. There was no freedom for LGBT people, etc. And the moment that there was a change to a liberal-left government, of course, that government, the new liberal-left government in Poland, immediately ran into the media offices and expelled everyone and threw people out of the state-run media and has very aggressively tried to, arrest past politicians, all things that if a right-wing government did, there would be an international meltdown. There's of course a huge hypocrisy around this, but I think we're seeing that for the United States and the West, unfortunately, they're becoming more dependent internally on within the West on trying to get everyone to hew this culturally radical line, and it's not very convincing, and it's really not a good way of spreading international influence.
Well, let's change gears here. You're advising. You're trying to get a picture of what the lay of the land is for Hungary. What do you think is what is the biggest problem facing the West? Not to put you on the spot.
Well, small question there, and thankfully we have, 30 plus years of First Things magazine to help guide us on this topic. But on the international level today, it's like there's an inability for the Western elite to even discuss the consequences of their actions. And these are the people who also argue that having a liberal free speech environment is the most important thing because we can all discuss the positives and minuses of every issue. Well, can we discuss whether the sanctions regime that was imposed on Russia after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, can we discuss whether that has been Effective or ineffective? No. Can we discuss whether the lack of cheap energy is destroying Europe? No. You know, can we discuss whether the American foreign policy elite made terrible decisions for 30 years with basically impunity? No. And instead, what happens in the West is that Victoria Nuland finally retired or left her position in Washington. You know, the next day she gets a wonderful fellowship at Columbia and, you know, celebrating her 30 years of accomplishments, kind of accidentally destroying, you know, real Western strength through her decisions.
That's the country of Ukraine, arguably.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So the lack of an ability to even discuss these things or have serious discussions, I'm thinking at the international level. Of course, there are a lot of other problems within the West, but from an international affairs standpoint, the fact that we can't even have these discussions is a real barrier to good decision making.
So a kind of mindlessness or maybe ideological autopilot is what concerns you.
There's an ideological autopilot, and then there's actually a decision autopilot that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're fond of pointing out that we have the same pretty much set of politicians today as and decision makers today as in the 1990s. It's the gerontocracy, as my colleague in American Affairs, Julius Krein, has called it before. But the analogy I use is that they're still sitting in the cockpit of the mid-1990s and imagining that the American-led global liberal order is humming along and, oh, there's a little problem over here, so we're going to press the 15-day war button and drop some bombs and things will be fine, you know, as happened in 1991 in Iraq. Or we'll press the sanctions button because, well, you know, we're the biggest economy and we can sanction everyone. And as they pointed out, or as they argued after the Russian invasion, the Russian economy is only the size of Italy's. So could we sanction Italy? Of course we can sanction Russia, no problem. Mm-hmm. And so they're sitting there pressing the same buttons, but different consequences are resulting. And, you know, this is the classic definition of insanity. you press the same buttons and something different happens that, you know, other than what you expect, and you keep doing it. The situation.
I think there's, just stepping back and at, you know, 30,000 feet, as a baby boomer, late baby boomer, please forgive me, but I am a baby boomer, and I think the baby boomer mentality, it takes for granted all of the tremendous social capital of the Great Calm after World War II, and the vast middle class consensus, stable family life, economic prosperity, and so baby boomers, I think, just cannot recognize that there are limits to what you can spend down. That's true, I think, in domestic policy with respect to things like gay marriage, which I think is, you know, you're spending down the cultural capital of a traditional marriage for the sake of this project of so-called inclusion. But also it's true, I think, about American power, because I agree, baby boomers, they came of age in decision-making positions, junior often, during the 90s when it seemed like there was really nothing that could stand in the way of what we wanted as a country. It's a dangerous mentality, in my mind, to not recognize the reality of limits.
There's one area where they kind of reversed their decisions without any discussion at all. And this is that in the 1990s and early 2000s, they had the model of liberal globalization. We need to have a more connected world so that everyone can shop with the same global brands and travel globally, and borders won't matter, and the elite everywhere can mix into a global monoculture. And between, well, COVID and the response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, they kind of threw that model out. Suddenly they said, well, we have to cut ourselves off from energy sources abroad for political reasons. We're going to try to isolate the different parts of the global internet and, you know, make it impossible for you to access dangerous foreign sources. We're going to weaponize the financial system, and we're going to have a global decoupling. The West needs to decouple from China and Russia. And somehow this represents a like a snap decision that they made. Suddenly, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s, the attitude was, well, what, we've got to have McDonald's everywhere. And so the day after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it was, it is immoral to operate a Western business in Russia. Everyone needs to leave. And they somehow changed their mind on this without any discussion, which is also kind of scary.
Did they really change their mind, though? Because my impression is all these measures are for the sake of defeating the enemy so that we can reimpose or finally achieve the liberal global order. I mean, it'd be one thing to sort of say, okay, wow, there's been a real change of mind. I'd find that a little bit more reassuring, as opposed to, don't worry, children, these are just measures for the present, but and then we're going to get back to the old song. You know, we're going to get back to the old plan.
Yes, I think it wasn't like a genuine internal reevaluation of the consequences of globalization or something like that. It was also, I think one element of it is that Western power has obviously been slipping globally. Maybe on some sense they realize that their power is weakened globally. But in the last few years, the power of the liberals within the Western world has become more hegemonic. So they've become, I think, and specifically the U.S. and the U.S. liberal regime has become, you know, stronger locally and globally weaker. So their institutions, educational institutions, the media are even more hegemonically, you know, oriented around liberalism. Whereas on a global level, the type of competition that is occurring is much more practical. So they've become more ideological. That's helped their power at home. And yes, of course, it's about keeping and securing power. But I think the vision of reconverting the world to liberal globalization is very far off.
It's for domestic consumption.
It's for domestic consumption, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, is the sort of globalist liberal rainbow more powerful? Because, you know, Hungary's a good example. You have what the press calls populist rebellion, whether it's farmers in Germany or, you know, workers in France. You've got Geert Wilders' success in Holland, Meloni in Italy. So I would agree that the kind of globalist liberal establishment has become more ardent, more inflexible, more punitive. But is it more powerful, or is it actually weakening on an internal basis?
Well, I sometimes call it white knuckle liberalism. Like they're clearly getting a little bit afraid that the consequences of their actions aren't as effective as they anticipated. So they're, you know, grabbing onto the seats, and their knuckles are beginning to turn a bit white. So I think that's correct. And you know, Hungary occupies a spot in Central Europe that has always been riven by conflict and has had different imperial dominations over the years. And so the mindset in Central Europe is inherently more practical. We know what an ideological regime looks like. We know that it becomes more ideological as it's becoming more nervous. And the mindset is toward practical cooperation. So one thing that's visible, very visible in Hungary, is that the current U.S. administration is trying to flex its power through these ideological levers, whereas our Eastern partners, Eastern investors, Chinese investors, Korean investors, etc., are basically just operating practically in the country without any attempt at ideological colonization. And so it's leading to an insight, I think, onto this mismatch of types of power that are being exercised on a global level. The U.S. has actually made it harder for Americans to do business in Hungary in the last few years. They canceled the tax treaty between the United States and Hungary, the double taxation agreement, which the United States still has with Russia. So they're actually putting Hungary under a light form of sanctions. But, you know, shouldn't the U.S. be trying to compete on a global level through investment, through trade, through building things. Like, can't we build infrastructure globally? Mm. And, of course, the United States has enormous, even with its turn toward the liberal left culturally, it still has such enormous global cultural power. Can't we match that? Can't the U.S. match that with investment and building things rather than, you know, occasional bombing sorties and, you know, more LGBT propaganda? It's like, this is not a recipe for truly winning hearts and minds over the coming years, particularly as more and more people see that the LGBT form of left liberal cultural agenda is burning out.
And it has a disintegrating effect on social norms broadly. Well, and so it's not a coincidence that, you know, marriage is in the culture of marriage is so much weakened in the United States, and then total fertility rates. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about just your sense about the European situation. I mean, Hungary makes the news because the Hungarian government has taken very draconian and expensive measures to try to encourage marriage and children.
That's right. And I just want to add one element to this, which is that if we value security and stability in Europe, if we want European countries to defend themselves, well, you look at all these polls that ask different European countries, are you willing to die for your country? And the numbers are quite low in Western Europe. You know, if people aren't forming families and having children, if they don't have a stake in the future, if their societies and the thing that they're attached to is being destroyed by migration, well, what is the social thing that you're willing to die for?
Well, that's a good point.
So these are they're related issues. And yes, the Hungarian government, starting in 2015, took measures basically designed to ease the financial burden of the transition into having a family. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people talk about this primarily through the birth rate, but the interesting number in Hungary is the marriage rate. And the number of marriages in Hungary has doubled since 2010 on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. And the number of divorces per year has fallen by about 25 or 30%. So it's really like a marriage promotion idea. The idea is to make everyone feel that this is a normal choice to make. Because after all, we believe in human nature. We know people want to form families. There's some reason that they don't. It's financial anxiety, cultural, a different cultural atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, what I've read also is that the financial incentives have been matched by, public relations campaigns by the Hungarian government to portray married couples and families as the foundation of a happy, good life.
Well, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but since we are here in New York City, I was on the subway and I saw two advertisements next to one another. One was for a hookup app, which was clearly oriented toward like getting together more than two people into these horrible romantic arrangements. And the advertisement next to it was for some prescription drug trial for depression or something like that. And I looked at these two together and I'm like, what could be the relation? And I was on the Budapest subway a couple weeks ago and there was an advertisement for pregnancy preparation services or birth preparation services, like for a private clinic. Here's the price for, you know, three ultrasounds and your prenatal consultations, and just get off at this metro stop and there's a picture of a, you know, happy expecting mother, and there's no bad advertisement. So is that just PR,
that,
you know,
right, is that PR? Is that authoritarian oppression?
I felt extremely oppressed at that moment. But what people see causes them to feel that there's a norm or there isn't a norm. And clearly the liberal left realized that occupying public spaces through its flags everywhere has an important effect. Mm-hmm. So Hungary has tried to do the opposite. Of course, that's not enough. There also have to be financial incentives, etc. But and there is no magic solution either when the global cultural world kind of circulates freely. Of course, you know, young people in Hungary encounter the same, you know, contrary messages from social media,
yes,
and et cetera, as everyone else does. So, but, you know, we're trying.
I, traveling in Europe and looking at the situation there, I must say it is kind of demoralizing. I mean, certainly for Hungary's future, Germany is really crucial. But it just seems like it's a fatally wounded country, spiritually, culturally, and demographic change now accelerating it, you know, birth rates in the toilet. As you say, they have the lowest level of young people saying that they're willing to die for their country.
Germany,
yeah. So how can Hungary survive if Germany is suicidal?
Well, we are our own country, and economically we're very close to the German automobile industry in particular.
Right, I gather.
The manufacturing purchasing managers index, the manufacturing PMI, is one way of measuring this from an industrial standpoint. And while Germany's manufacturing PMI has been declining in the last couple of years, Hungary's has been increasing. So we have a model of industrialization that's working at the moment. And I have to say, it does involve, partly because of our geography, a strong openness to the East. Mm-hmm. So Hungary's always been connected to the Turkic world, to Central Asia, to China as well, and to Europe. And Europe as a whole is a more globally interlinked economy. Hungary has managed to form a kind of connectivity strategy, is what we're calling it, which is focused on keeping our national sovereignty, making decisions that are in the national interest, but being very open. So culturally, though, so that's just the economic side, but culturally, Hungary is its own small civilization. It has sources mm-hmm. from within. And on that score, what happens in the German-speaking world doesn't automatically,
right,
you know, drag Hungary with it. It's an important question for Europe as a whole. I think that one thing that we're trying to disrupt on the European level is the idea that the Brussels liberalism represents the true Europe and everything else is against it.
Right.
And that's not true. Europe has incredible sources of strength. Everyone who goes there from a conservative mindset knows that and senses it, and it's about tapping those and putting them back on the political agenda.
I agree. I mean, Europeans as broadly are much more rooted in place than Americans are, and the sedimentation, the layers of tradition are quite deep, and so they can be eroded, but there's more substance there, so there's something to work with for renewal. So you would put yourself what as an optimist? Is Hungary going to lead the way towards a kind of renewal of Europe?
Well, the situation, as you said, in Europe is not very hopeful in some ways, but we intend to be a beacon of sanity. In the second half of this year, there's a presidency of the European Union. Hungary will have that. So the second half of this year will be articulating the Hungarian vision more strongly on an international level. And, you know, there's probably going to be a tilt to the right in the European parliamentary elections in June, at least according to the current polls. There mm-hmm. will be a majority center-right majority within the European Parliament, mm-hmm. Which would be a benefit because the left in the European Parliament is completely insane. But, you know, Europe needs economic strength to survive, and there's been a huge increase in energy prices due to the sanctions
mm-hmm.
and the move toward decoupling and de-risking in Europe. And I think it won't be good for the United States if Europe continues to weaken industrially and culturally, because we do share the same cultural and civilizational world.
Yes.
And it's important, that's why it's all the more important that we're having this conversation and try to think of more ways to link European and American conservatives, realists, and you know, political thinkers of our variety.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast, and I wish you all the best in your efforts in Budapest. And thanks for coming to New York.
Thank you very much.